This is the Education Gadfly Show.
I think they actually recorded her back in 1980.
Careful.
I think that David Bowie had Amber's haircut at one point back in the 1980s.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my guest co-host, the Arcade Fire of Education Policy, Janie Skull.
What are you saying, Mike, that no one knows who I am?
You're the upstart. You come in and you surprise people, you beat expectations.
I was kind of hoping I would be the Justin Bieber, but then again, I guess he got shut out.
Grammys.
I shouldn't be aspiring to be a shut out.
Don't ever aspire to be Justin Bieber.
Rick Hess, like Eminem, been around a long time. Right? White guy that likes to rap. Actually, have you ever heard Rick rap? I guess we haven't quite seen that. No.
No, I only remember our old colleague, Stafford Palmieri, rapping in our Race to the Top application video.
You're right.
That was quality.
Yes, that was quality. So, Janie, this week, the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, we released the State of State U.S. History Standards 2011.
What's as the Rick state would of say, them, huh? Boom.
Boom.
It's not looking good, Mike. It's looking pretty abysmal in terms of state U.S. history standards. They're not too good.
So you know what's so frustrating about this? This is one of these things. It costs no money, basically. Almost no money to write good history standards.
And the good ones do exist. It's not like you have nowhere to turn. You're just pulling this out of thin air. I mean, there are good examples.
Yeah, we gave South Carolina got a 10 out of 10, a straight A excellent standards, right? And so all you have to do as a state is cut and paste, right? That's
which
it.
Which largely I think D.C. did. D.C. pulled from South Carolina, I think Indiana. Maybe.
California,
yeah,
right,
and came out with a great product,
right.
Whereas other states just keep holding on to their really, really crappy projects.
Yeah. Now look, and we always know we've done these reviews of state standards forever, and people will sometimes get confused. Reporters will say, "Wait, are you saying that South Carolina therefore does the best job teaching U.S. history in the country?" And of course, that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah.
Because standards, they're just documents. They sit on a website, but they provide some good guidance to teachers. And if there's assessments linked to those standards, which in a few states still there are for U.S. history, they might get some traction.
Yeah, it was actually interesting. In a couple states, they actually provide extra material because they have these terrible standards and they admit that their teachers ask them for more concrete examples of what do I actually do in the classroom? What does it mean to say, a student can analyze and interpret well? What does that mean? What do I do?
Mm-hmm.
So, there's definitely a demand out there. And so it's kind of surprising that most states actually aren't meeting this.
Now, the most interesting story probably is in Texas. Of course, there's been a big controversy down there, and our reviewers slammed the Texas standards.
Yeah.
And I think people will sit up and notice, we get labeled as a conservative think tank sometimes, and we certainly are fairly traditional in our views. For example, we generally liked the founders of the United States, think that they
pretty good guys,
should get a shout out in the standards. We should learn about them. But Texas went way too far.
Yeah. It just seemed like a lot of what they actually included in their standards was not even true to some extent.
And that's
a
problem.
It was exaggerated and was misleading.
No, look, this is kind of like states that put in, that don't want to teach evolution in their science standards, right? Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing is, you can find political bias in other state standards. It used to be it was all bias on the left, that it was basically, history that would try to talk about the victimization of various groups and, ignore everything else to be a very sort of anti-U.S. history standards. Now you have this new phenomenon, at least in Texas, of bias coming from the right. But again, some standards like South Carolina, a very red state, or D.C., a very blue city, have done a good job coming up with standards that play it straight.
Yep.
So it can be done. All right. Well, lots more to talk about today. We're going to start by playing Pardon the Gadfly. We've got Amber's Research Minute, Chris's What's Up With That, and plenty of analysis and banter for your enjoyment.
Lots of banter.
Daniela, ready. Let's get started.
It's a good week. So question number one. Both President Obama and House Republicans have now presented their education budget. What are the differences and are they significant?
So what we're trying to say here is, look, federal spending is only 10% or so of the dollars. So no matter what happens in Washington, a few billion here, a few billion there, it doesn't add up to a hill of beans. I mean, Obama is out there saying that his budget is going to protect critical investments in education, right? And by then, that means that he's proposing to spend a few billion more in K-12 education than we are today. He's not going to cut it like a lot of other places. He's not going to cut it as much as House Republicans would, which they'd cut it in another direction by a couple billion dollars. What he's not saying is that many states and districts, they're looking at 10-20% funding cuts. And, you know, this little extra money from Washington's not going to come nearly close enough. If Obama was serious, that he really believed that education was a critical investment worth protecting, he would propose another bailout of state and local districts, probably to the tune of another $100 billion, like the stimulus.
I didn't know you were so in favor of the stimulus.
Well, I am not. I don't think that's a good idea for a variety of reasons. I think that states and districts have to face the music and deal with the new budget reality. But I think Obama is being hypocritical by trying to basically make this case that Democrats are for education, Republicans are against it. I can sense that he's going to run on this in 2012, that, you know, we are going to protect education, when he's not. If he really wanted to protect education, he'd actually put it on the line and say, look, we need to hold these districts mm-hmm. harmless from these cuts.
Well,
otherwise, this is all a sideshow. It's political theater, Jamie.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of evident in the fact that one of the largest chunks of the additional money that Obama wants to bring in is for a race to the top. And if you're really concerned about, you know, the actual students in classrooms and teachers and making sure that everyone has the amount of money that they need to actually do well, you wouldn't put it in a program that's basically extra. I mean, that's where it came from this year. It was extra money that suddenly the Department of Education had at its fingertips, and it was, what are we going to do? Oh, we're going to have a competition for it. I mean, that to me is not, when you're cutting down to the bare bones, that's what gets cut for me. Not, you know, necessarily programs that actually, or money that's actually going to very important programs that are established and are necessary, I would say, in school, but this kind of extra program that came out of nowhere last year.
All right. So to conclude again, the federal budget debate, a total distraction. Okay. Topic number two, Daniela.
As the New York Times recently noted, classifying by race is becoming increasingly complicated in our multicultural society. Have racial classifications lost their usefulness in modern America?
So the New York Times story, very interesting, indicated that according to these new Department of Education regulations, if you have, you know, even a drop of Hispanic blood, then under these regulations, you'll be considered Hispanic. And there's a lot of concerns about particularly how you label kids with more than one race, that what will happen is fewer kids will be labeled as African-American, more mm-hmm. kids as multiracial, more kids as Hispanic. Is it time to just stop trying to do this classification and say, hey, look, you know, majority of our kids are minorities now. Let's just stop it. Let's just give it up. Why do we need to count it this way?
I mean, what I think is interesting about this is, I may be mistaken, but I'm fairly certain that census data has been doing this for a while, that, you know, Hispanic is more an ethnicity that kind of overrides all the other categories. And you can be both Hispanic and Black. And then that's why you have something that will say white paragraph, you know, in parentheses, not Hispanic. So I'm not sure why it's kind of an issue now, but in terms of whether the classifications are irrelevant, I think on some level, yes, they are. If you have a student that one day could be, you know, counted as Black and another day as Hispanic, yes, that's somewhat irrelevant. But at the end of the day, I think there is still value in separating out subgroups of students, and whether we need to start doing that, you know, exclusively by low income data purely in education. I mean, I'm not talking about larger, you know, issues that other sectors might need. But for education, it seems that you could generally swap out low income and still kind of have the same, you know, the same value of separating out subgroups.
Well, right. So the argument of having all these racial classifications is that then you can learn, at least at the macro level when you're setting policy, how these different groups are performing. And we learn in education, for example, that we have an achievement gap, and we can find out over time if we're closing it or if different subgroups are making progress. And I think that's valuable. I mean, we know, for example, that African-American and Hispanic kids have made actually mm-hmm. big progress on the NAEP if you look over the long-term results. And if we didn't classify by race, we wouldn't know that.
Yeah.
So that's important. But I think, you know, look, as we become a society where there's a lot of kids who are multiracial, I think we're going to get to some point where it just is just kind of ridiculous. And we have to just give up on that. You know, income will not switch it out completely.
Not perfectly, but I think it will still show important patterns that yes. are generally what people are going for when they're trying to close achievement gaps.
Yes, that's right. But we do know, look, there's still a racial achievement gap that's separate yeah. from the socioeconomic gap. But, you know, Liam, one of our bloggers, definitely talked about it maybe be the time to leave this stuff behind, you know, move forward into our post-racial society. I have to admit, there's a part of that's quite appealing. And I think we're going to get to a point where it's just going to be ridiculous to keep trying to do all this divvying people up by race, and we're going to stop.
Mm-hmm.
And I think on the whole, it'll be a good thing. Okay, topic number three.
Last question. Michelle Rhee is back on the front pages thanks to the brouhaha stirred up over her teaching data. Does any of this stuff about her students' performance really matter?
No. I mean, no. Does she need to be an effective teacher to be an effective leader? That's why people say that, you know, effective teachers shouldn't necessarily become the superintendents. That's why you have people like Joel Klein that come in and step into these higher up positions. So, you know, I think a separate aspect is whether she purposely misled or lied about it, which, you know, you don't want a leader to have qualities like that. But otherwise,
look, I'll give another shout out to Liam Julian here. Is that he wrote in our blog fly paper. He said, look, the problem is that school reform has now become personified by Michelle Rhee. That had its benefits. I mean, she's got a ton of press and, you know, has gotten out there on PBS and in the Waiting for Superman and in newspaper stories and, you know, helped to carry a storyline that reporters found very compelling and helped get these reform ideas into the bloodstream where they might not have otherwise. The downside, though, is that a lot's riding on Michelle Rhee the person. And like all of us, you know, there are flaws and there are, you know, quirks, and people are going to go dig up every line of her resume and check things out. I mean, so this is the risk, you know, and can we find a way to bring the conversation back to ideas and not just be a personality contest?
Yeah, I mean, because,
you know, Randy against Michelle or Michelle against Diane. I mean, you know, how this is, we're eighth grade again and we're having these schoolyard fights.
Yeah, at the end of the day, you know, it seems like they really, there is no data to prove one way or the other whether or not she actually was effective or not, because there just isn't data that's broken down by, you know, her individual class going through school. So, it's kind of irrelevant at the end of the day. It's just something that one side can kind of use as fodder against, you know, kind of pro-Michelle people. And it's all about just her as a personality rather than how effective she actually is in her job now and how effective she was as school's chancellor.
But, you know, I guess, and I have heard this from some people who are in the education reform movement or getting involved more in the advocacy side, that, you know, people follow leaders and they rally around leaders even more so than they rally around ideas, you know, which, as being in a think tank, I think, no, that can't be the case. But maybe that's the way it is, and that any campaign needs a leader. And so right now it seems to be Michelle Rhee, for better or for worse.
Well, that's why we have the education gadfly, right? He is our leader, our Fordham personification. Well, so people can rally behind him.
Other insects are rallying behind him to march towards school reform. All right. That's all the time we've got for Pardon the Gadfly. Thank you. Well played, Janie. Daniela, thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
It's now time for Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
How you doing?
I'm well. How about you?
I'm doing great.
Good. So what you got for us this week?
We're in a hurry. Let's go.
Keep it short.
Why do we keep talking like the chipmunks? All right. So last week.
I'm just trying to mix it up here.
I know. And I'm sad because last week I got a little bit of grief from Rick for not covering the school board study that we actually did in partnership with AEI, Fordham, and NSBA. So I'm covering the school board study and he's not here.
Well, you can give him grief for
I'll
not
give him
coming
grief.
To the
Although,
I will.
Look, we got to give Rick sort of some credit. He did show up a day early to our studios to tape the podcast.
Right,
well, there was a scheduling snafu, and he showed up, you know.
Ready to go?
Ready to go. And I had to say, Rick, what you doing here? But it was nice. We got a chance to chat.
All right, cool.
Which was nice. Anyway, so he did try to come this week, but it just was not meant to
be. Gotcha.
Okay,
right. So this is the study that he did in partnership with us at NSBA. It's School Board Circa 2010 Governance in the Accountability Era is the title. Came out, a week or two ago. Presents survey findings for roughly 900 school board members and 120 superintendents. So I'm going to give you a little smattering of the more interesting findings. First, most school board members are lukewarm to cold about present-day education reforms. Over one-third, for instance, report that increasing school choice within their districts is not at all important to improving student learning. Roughly 40% say the same about a year-round calendar, and nearly 70% say the same about creating charter schools. Roughly half, however, see professional development as extremely important to improving student learning. Asked to rank the goals of education, most board members say that helping students fulfill their potential and preparing them for a satisfying life are the number one goals of an education, not preparing students for college or the workplace, which less than 10% ranked as number one. A couple other small tidbits. Three quarters of board members view insufficient funding as a strong or total barrier to raising student achievement, and nearly the same number cite lagging budgets as extremely urgent issues, even more so than raising student achievement. On another note, most school board members are better educated than most of the population. They have greater household incomes. Most report receiving no salary for board service, and nearly 40% in large districts report working more than 40 hours a month. So, bottom line, these appear to be hardworking folks who really want to serve their communities but not rock the boat too much.
So I guess one of my questions would be, is there any indication of whether they are kind of not, you know, really jazzed up about these reforms because they're actually against them, or because they just really aren't in the circles of, you know, of the reformers, and they don't really know about them. They don't really know the results.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the survey asked that question. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're just asked to rank a bunch of popular reforms, and school choice and year-round calendars and all these things come way at the bottom.
Yeah, it just seems like it's not even on their radar, you know?
Right.
Well, but that doesn't mean they're not informed or that they're dumb. I mean, look, if I was a school board member of, say, a small suburban school district, which I assume a lot of these people probably were, I would probably say that, yeah, creating charter schools may not be the top of my list. Mm-hmm. I mean, if your schools are doing pretty well, if there's not that many, maybe it's a small district, so it's kind of not that feasible to have lots of different options. Mm-hmm. You know, the whole thing about them saying that, you know, lifelong learning and wanting to be happy. And I mean, this is the same thing that you hear from parents.
Sure.
Right. And as a parent, I understand that. I mean, look, you know, do I want my sons to be, you know, am I focused on them raising their achievement and getting ready for college and the world of work? I assume they'll do fine. They'll go to college.
Yeah. But isn't the role of education? That might be the role of a parent, you know?
I know. Yeah. But when you're asking about your aspirations for your own kids, yeah, you want them to, I want them to go to a school where, you know, they have a good experience and they, you know, grow up to be happy and have good relationships. I mean, so I think if these school board members are, you know, parents, former, you know, parent, people with grown children, you know, they see it through the eyes of more a parent. And in the policy world, as Diane Ravitch would say, we see it through the eyes of a state, you know, as, you know, thinking about macro policy changes and things. And we say, okay, sure, at a macro level, we care about whether kids are ready for college and work. And these people might say the same thing about the country as a whole, the system as a whole. But for their little rinky-dink school district, you know, where they know the kids and everything, you know, they want them to grow up and be happy. I don't know. I just don't think that it's that surprising or that we should wring our hands and say that therefore they're enemies of reform.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't think they're enemies of reform. But I do think that if we're talking about, and this is a point sort of Checker and I wrote a forward, and one of the implications of that is then how do you think about accountability for the school board? You know, if you know, presumably these goals are sort of what you're going to, you know, sort of say, okay, these are the things that we're going to help push forward. But if we think the primary goal is happiness and a productive life versus, you know, raising student achievement, then sort of inadvertently, that means the school board really doesn't have any measurable goals by which to hold itself accountable if we think school boards should be held accountable. So, I mean, I think there's some, you know, trickle down effects of sort of how they think about the roles of education that's more than just philosophy and theory.
All right. Well, what song goes along with this study, Amber?
So since we need some changes in education governance, we've got David Bowie's Changes.
Still don't know what I was waiting for, and my time was running wild, a million dead-end streets, and every time I thought I got it made, it seemed the taste was not so sweet. So I turned myself to face me, but I've never caught a glimpse how the others must see the faker. I'm much too fast to take that test.
Changes.
Turn and face the strain.
Changes.
Don't wanna be a richer man.
Changes.
Turn and face the strain.
Changes.
It's gonna have to be a different man. Thou may change me.
Wow, Janie, I cannot tell any difference between Amber's rendition and David Bowie's rendition.
I know, it was the exact same thing. I think they actually recorded her back in 1980.
Careful.
I think that David Bowie had Amber's haircut at one point back in the 1980s. Okay, now it's time for Chris Irvine's What's Up With That?
Well, sit on down and tell me what's up with that. What's up with that? Yes, sir. Woo!
Don't get me wrong. I'm all for creative forms of punishment, especially in the classroom. Having spent a year teaching high school students in a low-income suburb of Detroit, I quickly learned that traditional forms of punishment have no effect on most troublemakers. The trick to teaching these students a lesson is by punishing them in a clever way that they won't forget. Shop class teacher Abigail Fox of Albuquerque, New Mexico, took that mentality a bit too far in early January when dealing with an unruly freshman. Police say that instead of sending the young man to detention, Fox obtained the assistance of other students to drag the boy outside and lock him in a large storage cage. Humorous? Yes. Deserving? Probably. Appropriate response by a public school teacher? Absolutely not. I mean, the boy had to kick his way out of the cage. The kicker of the whole situation, no pun intended, is that while Fox was suspended, she was suspended with pay. What's up with that? Any coincidence that she's also a 10-plus year employee of the school district? Nah, I'm sure they'd punish a first-year teacher the exact same way, right? Look, Miss Fox, I get it. I really do. There were days when I got so frustrated with students that I'd want to give them a light lashing with a ruler, or stick a tall cone-shaped hat on their heads for the day. But you know what? I didn't, because it's not 1840 anymore. And because at the end of the day, I would never treat a student like I would a dog. In my opinion, this teacher was taking her school's nickname, the Demons, a bit too seriously.
Okay, so the question I have, Janie.
Yeah.
Why was there a cage?
That was my number one question, too. What is that? What up with that?
I mean, what kind of cage are we talking about here, Chris?
Well, I think it was a utility cage or something like that. They said they kept gasoline and antifreeze in it and things like that. So
even
the police cited that as kind of being an additional reason for the danger of locking him in that cage.
Okay. Wow. All right. So we're talking about it's like an automotive. This is like a career tech
part shop class.
Vote class. All right. Wow. Yeah. I mean, you would think, don't schools, you know, they have to go through these checks where, you know, the accreditors come around, make sure things are safe, that there's a sort of risk management. I would think on their list would be, is there any cage around where children might get locked into? And if not, maybe they should add that to the list.
Well, I think the assumption there is that teachers will not lock students in cages. You know, like even if you have a cage, you don't think, oh, you know, we might not want to have that because Mrs. Jones might lock Joey in it.
All right. Now, look, maybe this is an unfair assumption, but I would assume that some shop kids would lock other shop kids in a cage if they had the opportunity.
That's probably true.
I mean, I'm just saying. I mean, look, I like Chris, have some experience teaching. You know, I remember a summer camp experience where a bunch of 10-year-olds were running wild in my cabin because I was terrible at it. And they were stuffing one another into lockers in that cabin. And so I'm just saying, you know, you just want to – you got to see through the eyes of, you know, delinquent youth. And then you can plan accordingly. Okay, but bottom line, yes, of course, 10 years a problem. You know, you got to do ridiculous things to get fired in this education system. And sometimes you can do ridiculous things and still get paid. You got nothing, do you, Jane?
I mean, what is there to say about this?
It's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous. All right. Well, good. Well, thank you, Chris, for bringing us that woeful tale. And until next time.
I'm Janie Scull.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show. You can always check us out at edexcellence.net. Signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.